Such a pretty, catchy piece of music. Hard to reconcile that with the fact that when you hear that song, there's people jumping out of buildings, burning to death, rolling on the ground, because that was the theme song to The Towering Inferno, one of those Irwin Allen disaster picks. But the song won an Oscar for its co-writer, Al Kasha, as did the other big disaster movie song from the Poseidon Adventure, The Morning After, which we will hear shortly, but not before we talk to the two-time Oscar winner, two-time Tony nominee, Al Kasha, who is on the phone with us from California. First of all, let's make sure you're with us. Al, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Dave. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning to you, Al, and thanks so much for being in the neighborhood, and welcome. So before we get to all the stuff that you've done in the past, let's talk about the thing that you're working on right now. You've got a musical that you have written, and it's going to be workshopped and done. Just tell us about Silent Tears.
Well, I had a meeting with the producers of Silent Tears. This is the third year that I've worked with them, and they asked me to come up with an idea for them, so I created this show of reaching 16 countries and six continents, because the message of the Supreme Master is such a great message that I thought that this really communicate her mission really in life.
When you say Supreme Master, you're referring to
Supreme Master Ching Hai.
Oh, okay.
Supreme Master Ching Hai wrote poems, and myself and about five other writers composed music to her poetry. And I was looking for the essence, Dave, within the poetry, that there would be some story that should be told. And the work tells the story of humanity in search for inner peace. And because you want to make sure that there's a personage, there's a people involved. And each one of the poems I noticed had different qualities of the Spirit of God.
Mm-hmm.
Without becoming too religious, but it really did have the Spirit of God. And there's love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, and
all of the things that I lack utterly, by the way. But can I ask, was it your initial idea, or did you climb on board a project that was already underway?
No, it was my initial idea. Mm-hmm. Last year, we did Real Love, which was a musical, and Supreme Master Ching Hai's life story is like a musical. She was from Vietnam, and she was very much involved with a man from Germany. They never got married, but they were in love with each other. And it's from two separate worlds. That was Real Love. This work this year really deals with the inner happiness and peace that comes from you from these songs, hopefully.
Okay.
And it's tied in that regards. And and so I created, I met with Bella and Crystal, the two ladies who produced the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that idea very much, and I read through all the poetry, and in my case, I wrote the melody to three of the poems, of the 16 poems.
Now, would you say that you're trying to match the Asian-ness of the poetry in your music, or is it more along the lines of Western music, even though the source material is Vietnamese?
Well, from my standpoint of being a Westerner, even though I basically worked along, without being pretentious, Dave, the pentatonic scale, which is the Chinese scale, which Richard Raj has used in the Kiss Me, Kate. I mean, in
King and I.
The King and I, mm-hmm. Correct.
Cool.
So used the tonic scale and the melodies that I wrote, and tried to communicate that to the other composers as well, so it has one sound about it.
So
and
let's
shows the dancing and the singing, how each part of the world communicates the inner happiness and love that is just very compelling from these poems. So it has a storyline in that regard. It has the theme, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, it sounds cool. And by the way, if people want to see the production of Loving the Silent Tears, it's opening October 27th at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles. And how long is it running?
It's just running for that one day.
Ah, okay.
And it's on at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and 5 o'clock. There's an art show of her work and meeting the people that have been involved in the Grammy winners, the Oscar winners, the Tony winners. The girls and Supreme Master Ching have gone for the best, so I think we have some really great people on board that are working on this show.
Cool.
What I've done in the theater before, as you know, I co-wrote The Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which is going to be playing out here for a month in at the La Mirada Theater on April 12th of next year to May 5th. So I'd like to see the folks who see this show to come to that show.
Well, yeah, that would be, I mean, that's two of your Broadway calling cards, one of which was taking Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which was a movie musical.
And
a rather beloved one in some ways. It has that wonderful choreography in it, too. And then you added some more songs, and it's been a hit. It wasn't quite a hit on Broadway, but it's been a hit pretty much everywhere else.
It's the 12th biggest book show in the world, by the way.
What brought you to Seven Brides? How did you get involved in that project?
Well, my brother, who's not alive anymore, my brother was a producer who produced Applause on Broadway. My brother, Lawrence Kasha, and myself, Al Kasha, were the only brothers that ever won the Tony and the Oscar.
Wow.
The only brothers that have ever accomplished that, so we're very blessed in that regard. My brother, unfortunately, passed away a few years ago. He was my one and only brother and older brother.
Right.
And in 1954, when we were just teenagers, we had seen Seven Brides, and we said, someday we'll put this on stage. And so we only used four songs from the original movie, and Joel Hirshhorn and I wrote eight new songs. So it's really a complete new score. And, of course, the dance, we kept the dancing, which is wonderful dancing.
Right.
That was done by Michael Kidd.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the main things that the movie is remembered for. And
oh, it's dancing. And it shows the one thing about the dancing, which is true of Silent Tears as well, is that you have an ethnicity from each one of these countries of how they approached, you know, from Thailand to Germany, how they approached the dances. So as well as you were seeing the dance against the music, and the thing that Seven Brides had was the conflict between the brothers and the suitors. So
right.
Dance is very important. West Side Story is another example of that too as well.
Cool. Now let's roll it back. Let's go back to your being a little Brooklyn kid born in the mid-1930s. Were you a Brill Building person? Did you skirt away from that area and go right to movie and theater scoring? How did you get into the biz?
My father was a barber, my mother was a beautician, and we lived across the street from the Vitagraph Warner Brothers studio in Brooklyn. And they used to do shorts there, so my brother and I used to run around, and my parents did the hair and beauty work for the little studio. And then I auditioned for Annie Get Your Gun when I was 7 years old, and played Little Jake in Annie Get Your Gun as the second year of the show, the running of the show. But I'm really a Brill Building writer, where Carole King and Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, and out of Madison High School and Lincoln High School, Neil Diamond went to Lincoln High School.
Oh,
we all became writers, and I had hits. I had six hits in a row with Jackie Wilson, so which I had met. And so as my brother loved theater music, I eventually got to that place. I loved rock and roll music and blues music.
That's why I have to ask, because your Wikipedia page and even your own website doesn't mention a lot of the Jackie Wilson songs that you helped compose. What were they?
Well, My Empty Arms, I'm Coming On Back to You, Talk That Talk, Sing and Tell the Blues So Long, Each Night I Dream of You, and Forever and a Day.
Well, you know, I have a Jackie Wilson CD at home. I bet I have a couple of these. I would have played them. I'm so sorry if I'd known. Oh, well, I got to do better research next time. But moving
well,
then,
you could,
yeah?
So I had Irresistible You with Bobby Darin, which was a very big hit. And what I'm proud of that is it's one of the few songs that Bobby didn't write. In fact, I think it's the only song, except for one other one, he didn't write, because he always did standards. Or if he wrote a rock and roll song, he wrote it himself.
So how did you and Joel Hirshhorn hook up and realize that you were meant to be a team like King and Goffin and those kinds of folks?
A lady named Harriet Wasser from the Bronx, New York, since you're from the East Coast, I think, Dave.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Harriet Wasser introduced me to Joel Hirshhorn. I was writing alone. And just philosophically, you have to agree who your partner is going to be. And Joel wanted to write for the theater. He went to performing arts, which Fame is based on, the movie Fame.
Mm-hmm.
So philosophically, we agreed with each other, and I said, and I'm very idealistic. I said, we'll be the next Rodgers and Hammerstein. So we maybe didn't go that far, but we went pretty far. We were pretty blessed, to say the least.
Well, what was some of your early theater work with Joel? Was Copperfield your first thing, or were you doing stuff way before that?
No, it was way before that. We had a record that was called Will You Be Staying After Sunday. We had a record called Let's Start All Over Again. And I was producing records. I produced Go Away, Little Girl for Steve Lawrence.
Oh, wow.
And I produced Blame It on the Bossa Nova for Edie Gourmet.
Oh, wow.
And actually, not for trivia, but I produced Aretha Franklin's first hit record with Columbia Records. She started with Columbia, Aretha.
Mm-hmm.
And John Hammond, who discovered a guy named Bob Dylan, had a heart condition, and he asked me, would I step in and produce Aretha Franklin? And I wrote a song called Operation Heartbreak, which was Writers Talk This Way, Dave, which was number 8 on the R&B charts, since you have a collection at home.
Well, yeah, no, it's just you really need to go into your Wikipedia page and flesh that thing out, man, because there's almost nothing there of this important, you know, historical music stuff. I mean, obviously Aretha Franklin had a jump to Atlantic Records for them to really discover where her niche was. But it's amazing that she hit number 8 on that R&B, on the R&B charts with your song. I think that's cool. But when did you and Joel start writing for the theater?
We started writing for the theater about 1968 or 70, around 70. We also wrote a musical. We wrote a musical called Pete's Dragon for Walt Disney. That's our musical.
Oh, you mean the animated film, Pete's
yes.
Dragon? But that was your guys, too. Cool.
And we got nominated for an Academy Award for that show as well, for the whole song score and for the song Candle on the Water, which was a hit with Helen Reddy.
My goodness. We're talking about...
Other writers, way, Dave.
I'm sorry,
and
what?
So I'm a big fan of other writers. So what I mean by that, if you look at my career, it's very eclectic because I took everything on as a challenge. So it rings from rock and roll to theater. But David Copperfield was on Broadway. We didn't run for a long time, but it was a two-hour animated special, Christmas special on NBC, which did extremely well with the ratings. So I never give up, and I hope that people go to see our show at the Shrine Auditorium on October 27th.
Well, absolutely.
It's only for one night. I don't know if you know that, but it'll be seen on 95 platforms around the world because of the power of the Internet.
Nice.
Nice. Yes.
But you know, I also do want to roll back and talk a little bit about the whole process of Broadway. So you sign on to do Copperfield, which is, by the way, not The Magician, but the Charles Dickens book made into a musical. So, was it crazy out of town? Were you rewriting songs over night after rehearsal? I mean, take us through. What was it like working on a Broadway show?
Sure, I could take you through that process.
Cool.
I'm working with David Foster now doing a musical about Jesus' life, by the way, totally different from Jesus Christ Superstar.
Okay.
But to take you through the process of a musical, you try to look for a story that is two separate worlds. And if you use as a model of Rodgers and Hammerstein, who had so many hits, and it relates to today, South Pacific, The King and I, and Sound of Music are the same story, basically. It's a rich man from a different country when two separate worlds come together.
Hmm.
And children, no wife, they know none of these men have a wife at the time. Their either wife has passed on or has died or something. And in South Pacific, it's a Navy girl, and The King and I, it's an English teacher. And in Sound of Music, it's a nun.
Right.
And it's a conversion of two people that come together. So that's what the process is. And the first song in a musical, just for young writers out there, since this is college, it should be called the I Want You song, What the Protagonist Wants.
Mm-hmm.
like in My Fair Lady, all I want is a room somewhere far away from the cold night air. So it's called the I Want You song. And immediately you must know the protagonist. Look at Guys and Dolls, again, two separate worlds, a Salvation Army girl and a gambler getting together.
Right.
So the two most unlikely people who you don't think will get together, not to be romantic, are two people who get together. And it's true of today's musicals as well. That's not old-fashioned, because that story will always be true in relationships of trying to find that other person. In the case of Loving the Silent Tears, mm-hmm. what we have is the theme of finding inner happiness, and where can you turn to find inner happiness. It's an interesting thing psychologically. People will remember songs more than remember dialogue. So when melody is joined to a lyric, you remember it. And it wasn't an easy thing to do, because these poems were not set up as songs, but you try to figure out how to make it into a song without changing any of Supreme Master Ching Hai's words at all.
Can I ask, we're talking, by the way, with Al Kasha. He's a twice Tony-nominated and twice Oscar-winning songwriter. Have you found inner peace over the years? Are you a peaceful, happy person?
I'm a very peaceful, happy person. Yes, I have found inner peace. I'm a religious person as well, by the way. I believe in God, and I've read about Buddhism. I'm called, like Bob Dylan used to come to our Bible study, I'm what's called a born-again believer. I'm a Jewish believer.
So, well, you're a born-again Christian, or you're a Jew for Jesus, then.
Well, I'm not a Jew for Jesus. Actually, God is for us. We're not for God. God is for us. But I've read a lot on Buddhism, which is, you know, whatever your mouth speaks is who you are as a person.
Oh.
And I think of myself as a spiritual person. I think everybody is. If the seed that goes into your mouth goes into the right soil, it'll develop good spiritual strength.
Now, I do have to ask, since you mentioned him, and since the segment that we did just before we put you on the air was our weekly Bob Dylan Sooner and Later segment, where we play a few Bob Dylan songs, I gotta ask, man, how did you meet him? How did you know him? What was he like?
Oh, I knew him very well. I met him many, many, many years ago when I was at Columbia Records at only 22 years old.
Uh-huh.
When they signed him, as I had these Jackie Wilson hits, Columbia Records had basically white artists. They had, and they really wanted to get into rock and roll. And John Hammond went down to Gertie's Folk City down in Greenwich Village, and he signed Bob Dylan. And at first, your audience might find this interesting as well as you, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Dylan's first CD only sold about 7,000 copies, and they were going to drop him. Columbia Records were going to drop him.
Yeah, it was called Hammond's Folly for a while, in fact.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right, Dave. And I was nervous. I was only 22 years old, and all these older men who were producers at the label. And I said, we can't drop him. And they said, why can't we drop him, Al? And I said, we can't, because his songs are too good. So we could have first dibs on his songs. Maybe you don't like the way he sings, because he would write these 7-minute songs. I love the new CD, Tempest. Mm-hmm. Now we go fast forward. And my wife and I are what's called our believers, and had a Bible study for 33 years in our home. And Bob Dylan used to visit the Bible study all the time. And he was baptized in our pool. In fact, he wrote his first Long Train Coming, he wrote in our home.
Well, I thought he was baptized in Billy Graham's pool. I thought that was the word that went out when it first happened in like 1979 or 80. It was your pool?
Three times in Malibu, and then at our home, and then in whose name did you say?
Billy Graham, you know, the evangelist dude.
That might be true. That I don't know. I only know what the experience I had with Bob.
But how come you had to be three times? One? How many times do you need? Is it like, you know?
Wife and I were baptized, and then we were baptized also in the Jordan River when I went to Israel. So.
Oh.
Okay. It's just a tradition. It's like, why celebrate Hanukkah or this year? We have Shana Tova, now we have Rosh Hashanah, and it was Yom Kippur this week.
Right. Although, again, since you're being a believer, it's kind of, I mean, what is your religion? I have to ask this. You know, you say a believer. What are you?
Well, I'm a Jew, as Jesus Christ was a Jew.
Yeah. But
well, he was. I mean, even liberalists will feel, and I have nothing against liberalists at all, but it says in John 4, it says, salvation shall come for the Jews. The whole messianic belief is a Judaic belief.
Well, yeah, but we don't believe he came yet. We figure he'll come someday.
Yeah.
After the Jets win the Super Bowl again or something like that.
I believe he's already come, and you believe that he's coming. Okay. So, but in both cases, when he comes again, we both believe in the same thing.
Well, there's some semantic differences there, but I'd rather hear about Bob Dylan. What was he like in the study groups?
Well, he's a seeker, Bob Dylan, and he's a genius, by the way. What I mean by that is that he would ask you 150 questions. What does this scripture mean in the Bible? What does this mean in the Bible? Talk about a Judaic mind.
Mm-hmm.
A good writing is always asking and answering questions, like Berlin, I got the sun in the morning, I got the moon at night. They're opposites. And that's the way the Bible is written that way. Jesus, your life, you'll gain your life. Faithful in little is faithful in much. They're always opposites. And it joins in with a question for its answer.
Okay.
So Bob, if you got to serve somebody, either serve the devil or serve God. You know, people ask me, is he still born again? That is his own personal thing, but he did write 34 songs about the Bible, so that's a pretty big...
Yeah, well, not only that. I mean, the thought was that after he got through those three albums of the quote-unquote born-again period, that he either went back to Judaism or just became spiritual or whatever. But if you hear the new album, there's a sense that he's still on some level a Christian, except he's reading all sorts of different religions too. So it's kind of hard. When was the last time you saw him?
I haven't seen him in about a year and a half, but I noticed that in the new CD, at least three of the songs in the Tempest CD of Bob Dylan are very, very Christian-driven, or if you want to say God-driven, whatever makes you feel comfortable.
Well, God-driven makes me feel more comfortable, but fine, either way, you know.
God-driven is what I would say, you know.
So,
Bob is a spiritual man. He really is a spiritual man. And I mean, if you go back to Blowing in the Wind, and every single CD he's ever done, since you look at Wikipedia, you'll always find one or two songs about God.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, definitely.
Even before he went through his journey being a born-again believer, he always wrote about God. He always did. And he after being born again, he did go back to synagogue, and he's always studied with the greatest teachers in the world. Hmm. He's a teacher.
Cool. I guess my last question about that, because I know obviously you didn't really want to dwell on this, but I'm so fascinated by every aspect of Bob Dylan that I can't help but ask. So the main question is do you have any funny or cute anecdotes about him, or what's he like?
Well, we were sitting at in a restaurant one night, and I didn't shyly, but I said to him, Bob, who do you like as a songwriter? Who do you admire? Because most people don't ask him that question because they feel that that might be presumptuous.
Well, we know it's not Donovan, so who?
He said, Chuck Berry and Lieber and Stoller is who I like very much. And he actually said to me, which I thought was very humble, he said, I can't do what you can do, Al. I said, well, what is that, Bob? I think you could do anything. And he said, you and Carole King and Barry Mann and Neil Diamond write the thing called hooks and songs and choruses and songs. I don't know how to do that. I said, well, just keep doing what you're doing. Because you're doing.
I'm sorry.
It was funny. He says, I really just don't know how to do that, you know.
Well, let me ask about your songwriting process. How often do you sit down? Is it every day where you try and work at the piano and come up with something new, or do weeks go by and you're just working on other stuff and then a couple of songs will come to you quickly? What's your process?
Well, that's a good, very good question. My process is I write down everything. I have a pad next to me. If you might say something, you know, we're both on the air now, that might turn me on, and I'll write it down and it'll turn out to be a song.
Ooh.
The process, I'm still old-fashioned this way. I look at the charts of who would do my songs and who would not do my songs. I'm always writing for Broadway, as writing this musical, Loving the Silent Tears. And so I work every day at my craft. I really do. Every day I consider myself I've written books. You know, if they ask you can write a song and notes on Broadway, I've written books on teaching songwriting. I was the first and only songwriting teacher in the country and this is not ego, at UCLA for years.
Oh, wow.
They would teach lyric writing, but they didn't teach the putting together a melody and a lyric, which is very important.
So I know it's impossible kind of to do in this situation without a piano in front of you, but what are one or two pieces of important advice that you would tell students who would come for your songwriting class?
Well, here's a pretentious word, but for them to remember it, there here are three important things. There's a word called prosody, P-R-O-S-O-D-Y.
Uh-huh.
And a good songwriter has excellent prosody. The meaning of prosody means wherever the words go, the music should go, like Burt Bacharach and Hal David, who just passed away. Hal David, unfortunately, a sweet man. But the moment I wake up, see, wake up goes up the scale.
Oh.
And the Beatles, let me take you down, cause I'm going through strawberry. The melody goes down. So as simple as that sounds, sometimes I'll have students over the years, Dave,
mm-hmm.
and I say, that's emotion goes up. Well, why are we going down? You know, climb every mountain goes up the scale. Climb every mountain goes up the scale.
You know, I have, speaking of musicals, I have to recommend a musical to you. Are you familiar with A Class Act?
Sure.
Isn't that a wonderful show? You made me think of it because it's all about the songwriting class that they used to, the Lehman Engel class that they used to have. And I'm glad that you know about it because I think that's just a marvelous show.
Well, I love Lehman Engel. My brother and I were very friendly with Lehman. Even though I'm an ASCAP member, but I love Lehman. He was a great teacher. And the second thing, you said three steps. One is prosody. The other is come up with a title of a song that has what I call associative adjectives. Like that old black magic has me in a spell. See, spell, that old black magic to weave so well. You must have been a beautiful baby. You must have been a beautiful child. Meaning, look at your Roget's thesaurus. Even Stephen Sondheim says he always has a rhyming dictionary with him, and he always has a thesaurus, a Roget's thesaurus book with him.
Huh.
Because so the audience to get settled. And write something that I say in my... I just wrote a new book that's coming out about songwriting. It's the most detailed book I've ever written. It's 315 pages. And it's called Moving with the Times. People say, why are you, Al Kasher, at this age, you still have your records? And you have to move with the times. You have to relate to what the audience wants to hear and wants to talk about. As you talked about Bob Dylan, The Tempest song is 14 and a half minutes, but he deals with what people want to hear.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if people necessarily want to hear a 14-minute song about the Titanic. I think there's other songs on that album that I want to hear, you know, more often and a lot more. But let me ask you, are there artists of, quote-unquote, today, people on the Billboard charts, the dance hip-hop folks that you really admire or respect or really like their music or not?
Well, no, I like their music. It's more lyric-driven than it is melody-driven. You know, they do tracks, and they work along those tracks. But I think he's in trouble now, but I think Chris Brown is a talented writer. Frank Ocean is very good, too.
Hmm.
And the one who wrote Is There a Ghetto in Heaven, the one that passed away, they got shot. He was Tupac. Tupac was a very good writer, by the way.
Wow, Tupac Shakur. I was not expecting to hear Kasha support Tupac. You're born in 1937 from such a different era, but it's important, it's cool that you have your ears open to...
Oh, no, I think Tupac a stone-cold genius, by the way.
Wow.
He wrote about that's the fourth step, not to make it easy, there's three steps. Really write about what you know and what you've lived and stay current as possible. And don't lose your morality, but stay current of what people are really interested in, if you want to have any longevity.
No, I'm sorry.
I mean, God has been good to me. I mean, I've had hits since 1959, and this is 2012 we're in, and I had, and God Rest His Soul, but I had Donna Summer's number one dance record. It's her last song that she did called I'm a Fire.
Wasn't your wife her manager or her,
yes.
her business person? Wow. What was Donna Summer like?
Oh, God, she was, talk about a great person. Not because she's gone, because we always say wonderful things about people after they're gone, but as much as she did love To Love You Baby, she was a very, talk about a spiritual person and a great, great artist, a great painter, by the way.
Oh, that I did not.
A lot of people should get into that, but she was a very fine songwriter. I'm not here just promoting myself. I'm here talking about Loving the Silent Tears. But only because you asked me about Donna, we were writing a musical of her life story, which we're going to do eventually. There have been offers for it. I can't announce the producer yet, but there have been offers from three major producers. So I'll write until I can't write anymore.
I know they've been trying to get a Paul Jabara musical off the ground for the past couple of years and get that to Broadway. So if that goes, I wouldn't be surprised if they want one for Donna Summer as well. And they've got a Motown musical coming. So, you know, if things go in threes, perhaps, you know?
The difference, Dave, is that we're doing a lot of necessary hits, which Paul wrote some of her biggest hits and was a very sweet guy. But we're doing a lot of songs that deal with her life story. You know, she was from Boston, and you know, her background, her character background.
Where was she born? Where was Donna Summer born?
She was born in Boston.
Mm.
Her real name was Adrian Gaines, by the way. Adrian Donna Gaines.
And
she was married to a German fellow at first. His name was Sumer. When she did Hair, and that was her first big break when she was 19 years old, Donna Summer.
Oh, I didn't even know she was in Hair. And the song, were you involved in her big hit song, She Works Hard for the Money?
No, that was Michael Omarion.
Oh, okay.
He wrote that. I was generally, she thought of me, which is fine, and I was very happy about it. She thought of me being a theater writer because, you know, she didn't categorize me. But that's why we were writing this musical together regarding her life story.
Actually, my wife is in the studio, and she has a question just about Donna Summer. Was she a working-class person? What was her background initially?
Yes, her father worked, I think, at Motorola or one of those kind of companies. And her mother, Mary, and she was the oldest of five children, even though Mary was married before, and there were two before, so there were seven children. So she was from working class, but she studied opera. A lot of people didn't know that. She had a great, I mean, listen to MacArthur Park, look at the range of that song. So she was a great, and that's why her first job was Hair, which she was 19 years old, where she auditioned for it and moved to Europe and was in Hair and then was a background singer. And just as a joke, she did Love to Love You Baby, and look what happened with it. She was doing a microphone and went on for like 7 minutes. But we were friendly with her and her husband, Bruce Sedano, who's a talented songwriter himself. We were friendly with Donna from 1978 till the day she passed away.
Wow. We're talking, by the way, with Al Kasha. We just have another 2 or 3 minutes with him before we've got to wrap things up. But it's been an absolute delight talking to him. I want to remind folks that Loving the Silent Tears has its one-day presentation at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles on October 27th. And I assume if things go well, there will be more life for the show after that as well. But I want to ask another quick question about your life that I found, not from Wiki, but elsewhere on the internet, and that was that you were, for a while, suffering from rather severe agoraphobia. Over that? Is still with you, or how'd you get over it if you did?
Well, I am over it, you know. Actually, I don't want to get into religion with you, but there was a scripture in the Bible that helped me a great deal. The Bible is the wisest book ever written, be it Old Testament or New Testament. And love casts out fear, and I reverse it and said fear casts out love. I'm a perfectionist at heart, and I have to worry about that. I don't worry anymore, so just do it. So my Jewish mother, when I won the Oscars, she said, "Tim, someday when you win a Tony on Broadway, then I'll know you've been successful."
Great. Thank you. The Oscar wasn't enough for her. She needed a Tony, right?
Enough was never enough for her.
She was a Jewish mother.
Yeah, I called her the East Coast distributor of guilt, you know.
And actually, I think there is a line in the Bible somewhere where it just says, "Get the hell out of your house." So if you found that particular passage,
I think you're right. It says, you know, witness and work with other people. It's in Proverbs by Solomon, so it's true. I did suffer with agoraphobia, and if people want to call me regarding it, I have an organization that I put together called Faith Over Fear.
Faith Over Fear. And, but it's a faith organization, but it's non-sectarian, so it doesn't matter what faith
you
are.
It's non-sectarian. We have from Buddhists, Catholic, Jews, you know, Hindus, we have everybody. That to me is the most important. If someone asks you what's the most important thing you've done in your life, I would say marriage to my wife, my daughter, my grandchild, and helping people get over agoraphobia.
Nice.
And if my songs can do that, that's even better.
Last question for Al Kasha. What is the most recent song that you've written, and when did you write it?
Oh, God, the most recent song that I've written, I guess I'm a Fire with Donna Summer was the most recent song that came out. I have some songs that are coming out, but that's the most recent song that was a big hit.
Well, no, I'm not talking about hit. I'm talking about last time you sat at the piano, or maybe you do a guitar as well, and wrote a song. Not on anybody's album, just, ooh, I've written a song. When was that?
Oh, God, let me think. I'm always writing songs.
Yeah.
So I wrote a song called Step Into the Light, mm-hmm. which is not a religious song. It's just step into the light and leave the world behind, you know.
Was it dedicated to someone who recently died, or some?
Yes, actually.
Who?
It was the thing with Donna Summer, in fact, you know, to tell you the background of it.
Oh, okay.
The person who was the most... Well, here's a quick story about her, which I think she inspired me. She was on a flight from Japan with my wife, and the lady from...
Hello?
From Salvation Army was there. And she was the head of Salvation Army, Dave. And she was called General. And Donna Summer put her hand in her pocket and didn't want... But now that she's gone, I can share this story.
Sure.
And she gave the lady $10,000 to help people. And how gracious it was. And she said to my wife, don't tell her who gave her the money. So to me, the most important thing, if I can give hope to people, then that to me is the most important thing. If you look at my song, The Morning After, it always deals with hope. And I try to have hope in as many songs as possible.
Well, I'm certainly glad that you mentioned The Morning After, because we're gonna end the interview with that song by Maureen McGovern. Of course, it's the Oscar-winning song from The Poseidon Adventure, co-written by Joel Hirshhorn, and our guest in the neighborhood, Al Kasha. It's been absolutely fun and delightful talking with you. I wish you much health and continued success. Many more songs, many more musicals, and many more Bob Dylan encounters. I think that would be fun, too. So thank you so much, Al, for joining us in the neighborhood today. It's been great.
Thank you so much, Dave. I appreciate it very much.
And
thank
best
you.
Of luck with Loving the Silent Tears. Everybody remember, October 27th at the Shrine Auditorium. Wish I could be there. Thanks, man. Thanks so much.
Please come.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.